WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, paperback publishers of The Kalahari Typing School for Men, the new novel by Alexander McCall Smith.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Squires, is spending his days communicating with Mars. He's the principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Squires is also a professor of astronomy at Cornell University. The two rovers are equipped with sophisticated instruments to search for evidence that the planet was once wet enough to be hospitable to life. Squires and his team helped design and test those instruments, which are currently gathering and transmitting information about the planet. Squires has been analyzing the data as it comes in. Spirit was launched last June, Opportunity was launched in July, they landed on Mars in January. We invited Squires to talk with us about some of the mysteries of the planet and some of the larger questions about life itself that he hopes the rovers will help us answer. Let's start with the focus of the current mission. I asked Squires why the search for water is so important.
Well, you can think of water as being something that we believe to be a necessary condition for life. I mean, the thing that is driving our interest in Mars is the possibility that life may once have taken hold there. And when you ask yourself what conditions are required for life, at least as we know it, there are a few things. You need to have some source of energy. Sunlight works just fine. So does geothermal heat under some circumstances. You need to have the right chemistry, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, so forth. And then for all life that we know of on Earth, you must have liquid water. There are no instances that we know of life on Earth that don't require liquid water. And so that is sort of the thing that guides our search for life on other worlds is looking for water.
So what's the best evidence you have so far that there was once or there is still water on Mars?
Well, certainly, you got to be a little careful about how you use the phrase water on Mars. Scientists get a little sloppy with their terminology. And some people use the phrase water on Mars to mean the H2O molecule is on Mars in whatever form you can imagine it, vapor, solid, what have you. We know there's, if you define it that way, we know there's lots of water on Mars. It's been known for decades. Okay, there's lots and lots of ice at the Martian poles. There's water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. This has been known for a very long time. If you're talking about liquid water on Mars, that's a very different matter. No one has ever found liquid water on Mars today. But we're finding, I think, pretty compelling evidence for the existence of liquid water on Mars in the past. From the Mars Exploration Rover mission, the best evidence for that has come at the Opportunity landing site at Meridiani Planum, where we have found rocks that show very, very compelling evidence that they were affected by the action of liquid water and indeed probably laid down in liquid water.
What can a rock tell you about the presence of water?
Well, there's a bunch of things it can tell you. I'll give you two examples. One is you can find minerals in the rock that require water for their formation. Every rock-forming mineral that you can name has a specific set of conditions under which it can form. You got to have the right chemistry, you got to have the right temperature, you got to have the right conditions to make that mineral. And so you can think of the mineral as being kind of a clue, as being a sort of like a fingerprint that can tell you something about what the conditions were like. And we're finding minerals in these rocks that require liquid water for their formation. So that's one good example. Another thing that we're finding in the rocks at Meridiani Planum, which is where Opportunity is we're finding the distinctive signature produced in layered sedimentary rocks when they're deposited in liquid water, in particular when you find when they're deposited in water that's flowing. When water flows along, it can make ripples in the sand on the bottom of the water, and those ripples can then be preserved over geologic time. And they're when you find that kind of features in a rock, they're a clear indicator that water was there and was flowing at the time the rocks were laid down.
Now you think you found evidence that there was actually salt water once on Mars. Why is that an important development, that it might have been salt water?
Well, I think one of the things that's most important about that is that by having minerals that precipitate from the liquid water, it forms an environment in which you can actually really preserve evidence of what was going on in the water. The water provides a medium that might be able to support life. I mean, liquid water is a nice habitable environment, and there's lots and lots of organisms that can live in liquid water. But if all you had was a habitable environment and then that environment was transient and went away and there was no way of preserving what might have been in the water, then it's going to be hard to read that record. The nice thing about minerals that are precipitated from liquid water, such as when you evaporate water away and you leave salts behind, is that those minerals can actually preserve within their crystal structure, can sort of trap, like bugs in amber, whatever was in that water. So if you have interesting organic molecules, if you have biochemistry going on, if you have if you have cells, if you have actual microorganisms that are left behind, they can become trapped within those salty deposits. It's a very good way of preserving evidence of whatever was going on in the water.
So what kind of life might the water that might have once been on Mars supported?
I don't have any idea. Your gut tells you that it was almost surely, if it existed at all, extremely primitive. My reason for saying that is simply that if you look over most of the Earth's history, the life forms that existed on Earth up until, just 500-600 million years ago, were for the most part very primitive and simple, and they didn't really get diverse until pretty late in the planet's history. And that's on a planet that's had massive global oceans for virtually its entire history. So Mars, we're probably talking about much less water activity, water bodies that might have been transient, there for a little while up, and they dry up and go away, that sort of thing. So it's hard for me to imagine life developing to some great level of complexity on Mars. In fact, it's far from certain that life developed there at all. But, who knows?
So if there was once water and if there was once life on Mars, but there no longer is, what would that mean? That it all kind of came to an end? That it didn't work?
Well, that's a good question. There's evidence that in the past on Mars, conditions were warmer and wetter and more Earth-like than they are today. And one of the big puzzles of Mars has always been, what changed? What happened? Why did the water dry up? Why did the climate get cooler? We don't have really good answers for those questions. It's always been a bit of a mystery, but clearly the evolutionary paths of Earth and Mars have diverged a bit over time.
You're looking for signs of water. Signs of water would lead you to think that there might be signs of life. So you're looking for signs of former life also, but you don't know what kind of life, so you don't know exactly what you're looking for. So how do you go about looking for signs that there once was life on Mars?
Well, we're not looking for signs of life with this mission. What this mission is about is finding the right stuff for preserving evidence of life. It's about finding a what was once a habitable environment, and mm-hmm. we've done that. What's then going to happen is you got to look at this mission as being part of NASA's longer-range program of Mars exploration. Within another decade or so, the plan is to go to Mars and to actually sit down on the surface, collect some samples, quite possibly from very close to where we've landed at the Opportunity landing site, and bring them back to Earth and put them in terrestrial laboratories and be able to take those samples apart, in some cases almost molecule by molecule, and go through them and really look in detail for evidence of whatever was in that water.
And when do you expect you'd actually be able to get samples?
Well, that's a good question. It sort of depends on a whole lot of both technical and financial issues that are a little bit cloudy right now. But my hope is that in the early part of the next decade, we'll be bringing samples back to Earth.
We had a difficult time scheduling this interview with you because we had to coordinate our clocks. We on Fresh Air are on East Coast time, whereas you are on Mars time.
That's right.
What is Mars time and why are you on it?
Well, one of the things that really complicates our operations of these vehicles is that they are solar powered. They work during the daytime and they sleep at night. And they don't care if it's daytime or nighttime in New York or in Pasadena. They only care if it's daytime or nighttime on Mars. The Martian day is not 24 hours long. It's 24 hours and 39 minutes long. And that 39 minutes plays havoc with our lives. Because these rovers operate on kind of a daily rhythm, a Martian daily rhythm, those of us here on Earth who are entrusted with their care and feeding have to live on their schedule. And so each day we have a planning meeting at which we get together, we look at the data that we got today, and we plan what we're going to do on Mars tomorrow. And because of the difference between Earth time and Mars time, if that meeting's at noon today, then tomorrow it's at 12:39. And the day after that is at 1:18, and it progresses around. And so 2.5 weeks later, it's in the middle of the night. And we've been doing this for 11 weeks now, living on Mars time. It does kind of mess with your head a little bit.
How?
Oh, because you're living on a Martian schedule at the same time you're living on this planet, Earth. And so you're exposed continuously to daylight and darkness on a 24-hour schedule. You're exposed to meetings that we have to go to. The people who actually live and work here in Pasadena, the people who are JPL employees of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and are engineers who work here, their families are living on Earth time and they're living on Mars time. It makes life difficult.
Are you getting any sleep?
Yeah, you get an extra 39 minutes of sleep every day.
Oh, that doesn't sound bad.
as long as you stay on a hard Martian schedule and you don't let the outside world intervene, it's pretty good. When it gets tough is if you're in the part of the cycle where you're sleeping in the daytime and working at night and somebody calls a meeting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that's when life gets unpleasant.
Right. What is your typical day like now?
Well, let's see. I typically wake up at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Mars time. Come into the office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and the day sort of begins for the science team when the data from the spacecraft comes down that day. We're getting most of our data these days through an orbiter called Mars Odyssey that's in orbit around Mars and serves as a communications relay satellite. And that will overfly the Opportunity rover, which is the one that I'm working on right now, typically, about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The rover will shoot a bunch of data up to the orbiter. The orbiter will shoot the data down to Earth, and then we'll look at it and we'll see what happened. So let's say on a given day we might have planned a drive. There's a rock that's 10 meters away that we're very interested in, and we're going to drive to that rock. So we commanded the rover on the previous day to drive to the rock, and then when it gets there to take some pictures. So we wait and we see those pictures. And the thing that you're waiting for in a situation like that is, did we actually get to the rock? Did the navigation work properly? Did the wheels slip too much and cause us to fall short? Was there some kind of fault that took place on the rover, or did we actually get to where we wanted to? So we'll look at the data. We'll have typically an hour and a half to look at the data and figure out what we want to do. And then we all gather in a big room. This is the whole science team now, plus a bunch of the engineers. And we'll sit down and we'll plan in a meeting that typically takes only about an hour what activities we want to do on Mars the next day. So, for example, if we drove to a rock and we find that, yes, the rock is right where we want it to be and it's now someplace where we can reach out and touch it with our arm, we might plan a series of events on the rover in which we would reach the arm out and take some pictures with the microscope, which is on the end of the arm, or grind a hole in it with our rock abrasion tool, which is on the end of the arm, or what have you. So we'll plan those activities. At that point, most of the people on the science team go home. A few of us stay in for a while, and then a bunch of new people come in, and it's the job of that group to formulate the exact sequence of commands, the exact computer language that will be transmitted to the rover the next morning to instruct it to do what we want it to do on the next sol, the next Martian day. We call them sols. And then we just repeat the cycle, and we do it again and again and again, and we've been doing it for a couple months now.
What do you call the typical Martian day?
A Martian day we call a sol, S-O-L. We found very early, in fact, that terminology dates back to the Viking mission back in the 70s. When you start saying, well, we're going to do it 5 days from now, do you mean 5 Earth days or do you mean 5 Martian days? And when a word like day becomes ambiguous to you, you find that you need some new terminology. So a Martian day we call a sol. And then what happened on Mars the previous day we say happened yestersol.
Why sol?
Sol is it's from the Latin word for sun.
My guest is Stephen Squires, NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Squires is my guest, the principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. You helped design some of the tools that you were using to do research and capture information from Mars. Can you talk about some of the kind of coolest gizmos that are being used right now?
Yeah, well, we got a lot of cool gizmos. You can sort of take the scientific tools on this vehicle and break them down into two pieces. One part is for looking off into the distance, and then the other part is for kind of getting up close and personal with the rocks once we found good ones. For looking off in the distance, we got two instruments. One is a spectacular set of cameras. We call them Pan Cam. And they're very, very high resolution cameras. Color, I mean, most of the really spectacular images that you've seen and all the color images came out of the Pan Cam camera. They're the equivalent of 20/20 vision. We gave our robot geologists 20/20 vision so that they could look off into the distance and find interesting targets from quite far away. So that's one of the instruments for looking off in the distance. The other one is, it's called MINITESS, which is short for Miniature Thermal Emission Spectrometer. It's an infrared spectrometer that can look off into the distance and from a distance tell you something about what rocks are made of. Once we have found targets, rocks that we think might be interesting for one reason or another, we can then, of course, drive over to them because the rover has the ability to move. And then on the front end of the rover, there's an arm. And it's got a shoulder and an elbow and a wrist. It's basically the same dimensions as a human arm. And on its hand, it's got four fingers. One of those is a microscope for looking at the rocks, you know, really at really high resolution, really detailed. There are two other spectrometers, and each of those is aimed at telling us in much more detail about the composition of the rock, what minerals are there, what chemical elements are there. And then finally, we've got this thing we call the RAT. RAT, the rock abrasion tool. And what that is a grinding tool that we can press up against the rock, and it can grind away the outer layers of a rock and kind of open a window into the interior of the rock that the other instruments can then look into.
Wow. And how do you control these tools? Do you have like a joystick or a keyboard?
You know, I wish you could joystick it, right? You know, what I'd love to be able to do, especially when we're doing a drive, is to just sit there with a joystick and steer the vehicle, you know, around the rocks and that kind of thing. But the reality is that Mars is so far away. I mean, even when we landed, which was when Mars and Earth were closest to one another, it took 12 minutes traveling at the speed of light for a command to get to Mars, and then another 12 minutes traveling at the speed of light for the signal to get back. And the planets have moved much farther apart, and so it's much more time now. So you don't have any real-time control. So what you have to do is you put together a list of commands, and it's done by people sitting at computer monitors with keyboards and, you know, a mouse and that kind of thing, and putting together a list of commands, and then all the commands at once, everything that the rover is going to do for an entire day is transmitted to the rover, receives the commands, and then totally on its own, it just goes off and does all of those things. So we've actually endowed it with a certain amount of autonomy, a certain amount of artificial intelligence, I guess you could call it, so that it can do those things by itself without the ground intervening, because we're simply too far away to help it.
How fast can the rovers drive?
Pedal to the metal, just as fast as you can go. They're about 6 centimeters a second. That's about how fast they'll go, so 2 inches in a second. They don't exactly go screaming along. They actually, when we drive them, we actually drive them more slowly than that because we sort of like to have them stop and take a look around every so often, think a little bit about what the obstacles ahead of them might be. But we think that when we get out onto the plains of Meridiani in particular, that we might be able to drive as much as 100 meters in a single Martian day. At Gusev, where Spirit is, the terrain is much rockier and more rugged, and we've been typically averaging maybe 30, 35 meters a day, something like that.
Do you start to think of the rovers as being alive because of the artificial intelligence you've designed into them?
That's only one of the reasons that we think of them as being alive. And you got to realize, some of us have been working on this concept for more than a decade, and working on these particular pieces of hardware for better than 4 years now. And you know, you endow these things with your hopes, your dreams. You just pour your all your hopes and efforts into these things. And yeah, they very much become alive for you, not just because of the the software that we've put into them and the artificial intelligence and the fact that they get a little cantankerous from time to time, but just the fact that they're sort of extensions of ourselves, and when they're doing well, we're proud, and when they're having trouble, we get worried. And I would use a word like love very advisedly when talking about a hunk of metal, but we love these machines.
And did you give them any personal effects or anything to take to Mars, of things of your own?
That's a good question. Everybody likes to sign their work, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And so stashed away in various places on both vehicles are lots and lots of little things, all kinds of little things, people's initials, plaques with the names of engineers who worked hard on these things. There are lots of little personal touches, yes.
Stephen Squires is NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. He's also a professor of astronomy at Cornell University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Squires, NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. They landed on Mars in January and are searching for evidence that Mars once had water that could have supported life. Squires' team helped design and test the instruments that are gathering the information, and he's been spending his time analyzing the findings as they come in. In order to stay in sync with the rovers, he's living on Mars time. To distinguish an Earth day from a Mars day, which is 24 hours and 39 minutes, his team calls a Mars day a sol. What's been the most exciting moment for you so far?
Oh, my goodness. Wow. It's hard to pick any one. I'll give you two.
Sure.
One was when Spirit first rolled off of its lander and had six wheels in the dirt. The landings were great. The launches were great. But launches, landings, when we shipped the hardware to the Cape, all of those were things that I sort of viewed as kind of milestones along the way. But we weren't really ready to begin our exploration. The vehicle wasn't really in its native environment until it had six wheels on Martian soil. And as soon as we had Spirit with six wheels in the dirt, I knew we had made it. We had gotten to Mars. And that was a wonderful moment. The other one, I think, was the moment at which, for me, I finally realized that, my goodness, yes, at the Opportunity landing site, we were looking at rocks that were showing the distinctive signs of liquid water. And that was an interesting thing, because that was a story that kind of unfolded slowly. We would have one clue and then another and then another and another. And sooner or later, the clues add up to tell a story. But the thing that was interesting was that, I've got 100 and some odd scientists on my team, and everybody comes into the mission with their own set of kind of prejudices and beliefs and expectations about what we're going to find on Mars. And some people came into the mission, thinking it was really likely we'd find evidence of water, and some were very skeptical. And it was very interesting to watch my whole team and watch as each clue was revealed to us by the rover, at what point each person sort of fell over that cliff and decided, oh yeah, we really are looking at evidence of water. I remember the exact moment that it was for me. There was a particular image that showed some features that it was so compelling that I became convinced. But for each person, it came at a different time, and it was very interesting to watch the team as this realization grew on us.
What was one of the worst moments during this mission?
Oh, that's easy. The worst moment since we landed was the anomaly that we had with Spirit on Sol 18. On the 18th Sol of the mission, we lost contact with the vehicle. And in fact, it was worse than that. We lost control of the vehicle. There was a problem with the software on board the vehicle. We didn't know that at the time. We had no way of knowing what was going wrong, because the only symptom that we had was that, the vehicle wasn't talking to us. And there was a heart-wrenching two or three sols there where the vehicle was beyond our control. We knew that it was awake all night, kind of thrashing around and burning the batteries down. And it was a very, very frightening thing. And then some just brilliant detective work by some of the software engineers here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They figured out not only what was probably going wrong, but a way to bypass the problem and get the vehicle back under control. And so after about three sols of this, which was, it was right before Opportunity landed too. It was very, very close. They managed to get control of the vehicle, and we finally recovered completely and were off and running again. But that was definitely the worst moment since we landed. Now, prior to that, before launch, we had a lot of bad moments, just an awful lot of them. The development of this mission was just an emotional roller coaster ride. We had a very short period of time to do it in, and we had all kinds of failures. We had parachute tests that failed, parachutes that we were relying on that when we deployed them just shredded, just ripped to ribbons. We had airbags that we were counting on that when we tested them just tore, ripped. We didn't have our first successful parachute test until 8 months before we launched. There were a lot of very, very disheartening, frightening, terrifying times during the development of this thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Squires, and he's the principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Can we talk a little bit about the surface of Mars?
Sure. It's one of my favorite places.
What is the most and least recognizable aspects of it? If you were to compare the surface of Mars to the surface of Earth, what looks most the same and what looks the most different? Let's start with the same.
It depends a lot on where you are. That's a hard question to answer.
Okay.
You know, if you look at the two Viking landers and the Pathfinder lander and our landing at Gusev Crater with Spirit, all of those places look pretty similar. They were kind of flat, boulder-strewn plains. They had kind of a very familiar, what's become a familiar Martian-looking look to them. But that's deceiving. That's misleading, because the reason that those places all looked much the same is that there are certain rules, certain criteria that you have to follow for landing safely on Mars, and they tend to lead you to flat plains. When we landed at Meridiani Planum with Opportunity, all of a sudden we saw a very different Mars. We saw a place that was unlike anything that we'd seen on Mars before. And the fact is that if you could go to the spectacular places on Mars, if you could go to the mountainous places, if you could go into the deep canyons, you could see some incredible scenery, spectacular topography. And we just simply haven't been able to build landers that can safely land in these extremely dangerous places yet. That will come someday. But right now we don't have that capability. So if you sat down on the surface of Mars at kind of a typical place, the things that would be familiar would be, you'd see rocks lying around. You would see drifts of sand and dust. It doesn't look like many places on Earth. It doesn't look like most places on Earth. But if you go to some of the world's most desolate deserts, places where there's no vegetation, places where you have, where there's no rain, where the primary geologic activity involves wind blowing stuff around, there are places like that in the Atacama Desert and in South America and dry valleys in Antarctica, some places that look sort of like that in Iceland, actually. You can see places that look very much like Mars. The things that would be different, well, first of all, the sky's pink, which is a little weird. So that would catch your eye immediately. It's brutally cold. It will get reasonably warm during the daytime, but then go down to 100 degrees below zero at night. So it's a pretty tough place to operate. The air is extremely thin. It's made of carbon dioxide. You can't breathe, so you'd have to be in a spacesuit. The gravity is only 1/3, so if you can jump 2 feet in the air on Earth, you could jump 6 feet in the air on Mars, which would be kind of cool. It would be very unfamiliar. You'd have the pink sky. You would have a lot of things that didn't look like Earth, but it would look more Earth-like than if you were standing on the surface of Mercury or Venus or the moons of Jupiter or Saturn or what have you.
How do you get the technology, you know, these kind of robotic devices that you have up there, how do you get them to survive in the cold and without the gravity?
That's actually one of the toughest challenges that we face, is coming up with designs that can survive the environmental conditions. There's a bunch of environmental conditions that you need to worry about. One of them is the environment of launch. Just strapping something on top of a rocket, you go through very intense acceleration, very intense vibration. You have to test all of your hardware to make sure it'll survive that. So the hardware that we build has to be pretty sturdy, pretty beefy, just so it can take that. There's a pretty substantial jolt when you land. You hit the surface at what might be, 20, 25 Gs, and that's a pretty solid kick. All of our hardware gets tested for that. They're terrifying tests to watch. You know, you build this hardware and you work on it so carefully and lovingly, and then you strap it on top of this vibration table and it starts to shake and this makes this violent noise, and you can see it vibrating and you can almost hear it screaming out in pain sometimes. And it's a little heart-wrenching to put your hardware through that test, but you have to do it. Designing the hardware to withstand these enormous excursions, these enormous variations in temperature, is very hard. What happens, of course, is when you go through, you might go through 100 degrees centigrade between the highest point in the day and the coldest point in the night. And designing hardware to withstand that is difficult because things are expanding and contracting and expanding and contracting. So we devote an enormous amount of energy to picking materials so that when they expand and contract, they do so by similar amounts, and so you don't have big gaps forming and things crushing together and that kind of thing. And then we test, and we test, and we test, and we test, and we test everything to more extreme conditions than we'll see on Mars. Every piece of hardware on that rover has been through 270 thermal cycles.
Wow.
From hot to cold to hot to cold. And the magnitude of that thermal cycling is 15, 20, 30 degrees higher than you actually experience when you're on Mars. And, you know, we test, and that was part of what made the development of this thing such a tough struggle, was getting all that testing done in the very limited time that we had.
Do you think there'll be any cool things coming out of the things that you've designed for Mars that will kind of filter down to the everyday level?
I very much doubt it. You'd be surprised, I think, to hear that much of the technology that we use is actually far more primitive than one finds in just everyday computer goods. I mean, the processor in your laptop computer is far more powerful than the computer in our rovers. Because of the fact that you can't go out there and fix it, because of the fact that once you strap it on top of that rocket and shoot it off, you're never going to see it again. Everything has to be ultra, ultra reliable on this vehicle. And so we actually tend to use very tried and true technology, in some cases stuff that's been around for a long time. I mean, the computer on board our rover was a screaming hot machine about 15 or 16 years ago, but it's pretty primitive by today's standards.
My guest is Stephen Squires, NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Squires, NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. During the Cold War, space exploration was part of the race for space. It was part of the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. And that's really, it's not political in that sense anymore. I don't think there's anybody close to the United States in terms of space exploration. And there's nobody, you know, nipping on our tail there. So is that a relief for you to just do this as pure science and not have it be part of, like, the Cold War or some other similar political contest?
Yeah, I think everything that we do is simplified by not being burdened with a lot of political baggage. In fact, the exploration that's going on right now is very international in character. I mean, yes, we have the two U.S. Mars exploration rovers on the surface of Mars right now, but for one thing, one-third of the scientific payload on our rovers is provided by foreign countries. Two of our spectrometers are provided by the German Space Agency. And then you look at other missions that are going right now. The European Space Agency, ESA, has an orbiter called Mars Express. And it's an orbit around Mars right now, and it's doing fantastic stuff. So Mars exploration has become a very international venture. And I think that just benefits everybody.
You are now looking at some really basic questions. Are there signs that there was water on Mars? And if there was water on Mars, did it actually support life on Mars? And if it supported life on Mars, what kind of life might have it supported? Are there, like, bigger questions underlying those questions that you're interested in, like, how was the universe created? What is life? All that, all those, like, the real big ones.
Yeah, I think there are big ones, and that truly is what motivates this, is the big questions. If you don't have truly big questions motivating it, you got to ask yourself, is it really worth the effort that we're putting into it? I think the big question that really motivates the research that we're doing is, how prevalent is life through the universe, and how did life first come into being? And we can address both of those potentially at Mars. if we go to Mars and we find that life did take hold there, then not only does that tell us something about the ability of life to take hold on another planet in the solar system, but given the multitude of planets that are out there around other stars, and astrophysicists continue to find new planets around other stars, it immediately, if all you got is one instance of life in the solar system, if you only know of one place in the whole universe where there's life, you have no way of knowing how common a phenomenon it is. But if you got two independent instances of life in this one very same solar system, it takes no great leap of logic or imagination to believe that life might be fairly common throughout the universe because there are so many other planets out there. The other thing is we can potentially learn things at Mars about how life came into being. Life developed on Earth. We know that because here we are. Okay. But what we don't know is how life first came to be. Life first came to be very early on this planet. And when the Earth's geologic record sort of first emerges, life is already there. If you want to try to find evidence on life on Earth of how life first arose, you can't find it because the rocks that date from that period in time are gone. They've been destroyed by tectonic activity, by volcanic activity. Earth has been a geologically active planet, and it's wiped out the evidence. Mars has been less active. Vast areas of Mars are covered by rocks that are 4 billion or years old or older. And so if life did take hold on Mars, not only, you know, might we be able to go there and find evidence that that took place, but we might be able to find evidence in the rock of how life first originated in a way that we could never hope to here on Earth.
How long can the rovers function in Mars if things go smoothly?
That's a real good question. We don't actually have a good answer for that. The design lifetime of the vehicles was intended to be 90 sols, 90 Martian days. That doesn't mean that the wheels are going to fall off when the sun comes up on the 91st sol. It just basically means that that's when the warranty expires. And how long they're actually going to last depends on how much dust builds up on the solar arrays, how well the power system and thermal system on the vehicles perform. We've gotten enough data now from the vehicle's performance to date to be able to run projections of their lifetime out into the future. And we've run those projections out to, you know, 200 plus sols. And in the projections, the vehicles are still doing fine at that point. And, you know, after a while, the seasons change on Mars. Of course, what's happening now where we are is it's drifting later and later in the year, and the days are getting shorter and there's less sun. But after a while, the seasons change and the sun starts coming back again. So these things could last a good long time. And in fact, it might not be dust buildup or the power system or whatever, what have you, that ultimately limits their lifetime. It might be something else like pieces wearing out. We're going to try to get as much of out of these vehicles as we possibly can.
So you're sticking with them as long as they run.
You bet.
What's next for you after this mission?
Long rest.
Uh-huh.
A long rest. This has been an exhausting, exhilarating, but exhausting experience. You know, we have a great deal of data now. It's going to take us a long time to do all the analysis and write it up and publish it. There are certainly other missions to Mars ahead. Personally, I'm involved at a low level in the next mission to Mars. It's an orbiter that's going to fly in 2005. I'm looking forward to Mars missions. But the Mars missions in my personal future, I want to be ones where I can have a lot of fun, but a bit less responsibility.
Right. And what's the mission in 2005?
Mission of 2005 is called MRO. That stands for Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's a great, big, very capable orbiter that has on it some fantastic instruments to look down from space. It has a spectrometer that should be able to find the spectral signature of rocks like the ones that we found at the Opportunity site on other places on Mars if they exist. It's got a camera system that has a resolution that's like 30 centimeters per pixel from orbit. I mean, we'll be able to see the rovers again, which would be kind of neat. So it's going to be a fantastically powerful mission. It's going to be very exciting.
How do you think you're going to feel when the rovers stop operating and the mission is officially over?
It's going to be a very sad day when the rovers are done. You know, we knew when we launched them that we were in effect, sending them on a suicide mission. We knew that they weren't going to come back. Even launching them felt a little sad. You know, I had always expected that launch would be just this wonderful, joyful moment. And in fact, as I stood there on the beach and watched the rocket climb away, I really did feel some pangs of sadness because I knew I wasn't going to see these things again. So, yeah, when that day comes, when they stop talking to us, as it surely will, it's going to be rough, you know, but boy, they've done such a wonderful job. You know, they will have done what we asked them to do and more.
Well, Stephen Squires, thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of the mission. And thank you for spending some of this Sol with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Stephen Squires is NASA's principal scientific investigator for the twin Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. He's a professor of astronomy at Cornell University. This is Fresh Air.